After you lost someone, it turned out you still had a relationship with that person, one you needed to tend to, as you would tend to a relationship with any living friend or relative. Coulson was, even now, someone she cared about and was at pains not to misuse. So she said, "I just wanted to ask if there was a photo of Bob your family wanted to share. I don't want to make things any more awful than they are. Your brother did something really special, you know? When a lot of folks would have run in the other direction, he went into Devotion Diamonds to try to help people. I want to acknowledge his bravery when we write about what happened. I also want to respect your feelings and do right by your family. But I'll let you go this minute if you don't want to deal with a prying journalist. My paycheck is not big enough to put grieving people through the emotional wringer." For a long time he didn't speak. Then he laughed again, a corrosive, broken sound. "You want to acknowledge his bravery? Man, that's hilarious. You don't know how hilarious. I know only one person who's a bigger pussy than Bob, and that's me. Our uncle made us ride a little baby roller coaster once, a thing for tots at a county fair, when I was 13 and Bob was 8. And we both fucking cried the whole way. There were 5-year-olds on that ride who looked embarrassed for us. I don't know why the fuck he'd go in there. It's completely out of character." "He thought the shooting was over," Lantern Glass said. "He would have had to been pretty fucking sure," said Brian Lutz, and when he laughed again, it sounded closer to a sob. "We cried on the little Zoom Zoom coaster. I even wet my pants a little. After we got off, our uncle couldn't look at us. Either of us. Just took us straight home. I'll tell you about my baby brother. He would have died before he walked in some place where he could have been killed. He would have just fucking died." 9:38 a.m. Lantern Glass had 2 emails speaking for Alona Lewis, Roger Lewis's wife. The first came through a lawyer at 9:38. Lantern Glass read it at her desk in the open plan office of the Digest. "Today, Alona Lewis grieves the loss of her beloved husband of 21 years, Roger Lewis, killed in the senseless mass shooting at the Miracle Falls Mall. Margot and Peter Lewis grieve the loss of their beloved son, and St. Percenti grieves the loss of a lively, good-humored, and generous community member." The email went on for another 800 words, all of it just as formal and forgettable. Alona and Roger had opened their first jewelry store in Miami in 1994, attended the Next Level Baptist Church, owned 3 Brussels Griffons, wrote big checks to the Special Olympics. Flowers might be sent to the Lawrence funeral home. It was a tidy professional public statement, and there wasn't a single thing in it that Lantern Glass could use for a quote. 10:03 p.m. The second email came from Alona herself, a half hour after Lantern Glass went to bed, but while she was still awake, lying under a single sheet and staring at the ceiling. Her phone pinged, and she rolled over to have a peek. Alona's personal email address was aliolewisgems@aol.com, and her message was just a single sentence long. "I bet he was fucking her." Lantern Glass didn't see how she could quote that email, either. July 9, 5:28 a.m. Rashid Haswar didn't have a listed landline. He didn't have a Twitter handle or an Instagram profile. His wife's Facebook account was private. He had a job at the Flagler Atlantic Natural Gas Corporation in the accounting department, but the receptionist refused to give Lantern Glass the number for his cell. "If he wanted to talk to you, to any of you news people, he'd call you," the receptionist said in a thin, indignant tone. "But he hasn't, because he doesn't." Lantern Glass had one other idea, though, so Tuesday morning she woke Dorothy before dawn and walked her out to the car. Dorothy was still about 2/3 asleep, her eyes partly shut as she tramped across the dew-soaked grass. Today she had on a thick white fluffy cap with a polar bear's face on it. She fell back to sleep in the rear of the car on the drive across town. The Islamic Center was in the black and blue, in a low and ugly concrete building, across the street from a strip mall that contained a Honeydew Donuts, a Bail Bondsman, and a discount shoe store. The last worshippers were already going in for morning prayers. Women through a door in the side of the building, the men through the double doors in the front. A lot of them were brothers and dashikis and kufis, although there were a few Middle Easterners among them. Lantern Glass parked herself in the Honeydew, found seats at a counter by the window where she could keep an eye on the street. Dorothy got up on a high stool beside her with a glazed and a big bottle of milk, but she had only one bite and then put her head down. Outside, the sky was a shade of royal purple, the clouds kissed with gold. The wind was freshening, and the palms rattled their fronds. Lantern Glass had been watching the mosque for 10 minutes when she noticed a slender, wiry man in a black baseball cap, his arms crossed over his sunken chest, standing just inside the donut shop's door. He was watching the street, too. The first time she looked at him, she noticed dark circles under his bloodshot eyes. He looked like he hadn't slept in days. What made her glance at him a second time were the words, "Flagler Atlantic NGC," embroidered on the breast pocket of his blue denim shirt. Lantern Glass kissed Dorothy on the cheek, her daughter didn't seem to notice, and slid 3 stools to the right, taking her donut and coffee with her, so she was almost right next to the guy. "Mr. Haswar?" she said gently. He twitched, as if he'd been stung with a fizzle of static electricity, and looked around, his eyes wide and surprised and a little frightened. She almost expected him to dart out the door and away from her, but he didn't, only stood there holding himself very tightly. "Yes?" he asked, no accent. "You're not praying." He blinked at her. When he spoke again, there was no anger, no defensiveness, just curiosity. "You with the press?" "I'm afraid so. I'm Aisha Lanternglass from the Digest. We've been trying to reach you. We were hoping you might share a photo with us of your wife and baby. We'd like to do our best to honor them, and you, your loss. Your family's loss. It's awful." She thought she had never sounded more phony. He blinked again and rotated his head and looked back out at the mosque. "I read your piece about the massacre." He didn't go anywhere further with this statement, didn't seem to feel the need to add to it.
"Mr. Haswar, do you know why your wife was there that morning?"
"For me," he said, not looking at her. "I asked her to go. My boss, Mrs. Oakley, was retiring. I was being promoted to her position. Yasmin ran by the mall to pick something out that I could give to Mrs. Oakley at the party. Yasmin always got excited when she had a chance to buy something for someone else. Giving gifts was her favorite thing. She was excited for Ibrahim to be older so we could give him things on Eid. You know Eid al-Fitr?"
"Yes," Lantern Glass said.
"It's when Ramadan ends." He nodded. "And you know today is the first day of Ramadan." Then he snorted with amusement, although there was no real humor in it, and added, "But of course you know. That's why you're staking out the mosque." He did not say it angrily like an accusation. In some ways his mildness was worse. She wasn't sure how to respond. She was still trying to think what to say when he added, "I walked Yasmin's mother here. She's inside with the other women. She doesn't know I am not praying myself, because the men and women pray in different rooms. You know that?" She nodded. "Yasmin's father couldn't walk her to the dawn prayer. He's in the hospital for observation. He's fainted several times since he heard the news. We're all scared to death for him. He had a bypass operation last year." Tapping his chest with his thumb, "She was his only child." He stroked his breastbone with the edge of his thumb, rubbing the place where his wife had been shot. He gazed blankly out at the temple and added finally, "Do you think it was because she was Muslim?"
"What?"
Lantern Glass asked.
"That she was shot? That they were both shot?"
"I don't know. We may never know."
"Good," I don't want to know. I dreamed last night my son said his first word. It was cake. He said, mmm, cake. Probably not a very realistic first word. I haven't dreamed about Yasmin yet. But then, I'm not sleeping much, he said. You're not eating your donut. I hate these things, Lantern Glass said, pushing it away from her. I don't know why I got it. Shame to let it go to waste. Smells lovely, he said, and picked her donut off her plate without asking and, making steady eye contact, took a large bite. Mmm, cake. July 10, 5:40 p.m. After they recorded the interview for Telling Stories, Jay Rickles said why not come to his house for supper. He wanted Kellaway to meet the family. They could open some beers and watch the show when it aired at 9. Kellaway didn't have anything else to do. Rickles lived on Kiwi Boulevard. It wasn't a mansion, no fountain out front, no white stucco wall enclosing the property, not even a swimming pool. But it was pretty nice all the same. A big hacienda with a red Spanish tile roof, and an enormous courtyard of crushed white shells. The front steps were flanked by a pair of green copper koi statues the size of Welsh corgis. Inside, the house was like a Tex-Mex restaurant, with lassos and bleached longhorn skulls mounted on the walls. It was crowded, too, with willowy young women in tooled leather boots and denim skirts and squads of little kids who crashed from room to room. At first, Kellaway thought Rickles must have decided to throw a party and had invited half the neighborhood. He was there for most of an hour before he gradually realized the girls with golden hair were all his daughters, and the small children were his grandkids. They rooted themselves on a couch the size of a Cadillac, done in tribal patterns, in front of a television as large as a Cadillac's hood. There was already a big steel bucket full of ice and Coronas on the coffee table, next to a dish of salt and a bowl of lime wedges. Rickles helped himself to a beer with one hand. The other snaked around the hip of a tall, leggy woman in a pair of Wranglers so tight they were close to obscene. At first glance, Kellaway thought Rickles was patting one of his daughters on the butt. At second, he saw that the woman next to Rickles was maybe as old as 60, thick makeup covering the finer creases at the corners of her mouth and eyes, and the yellow of her hair almost certainly a dye job. She had the toned beauty of someone like Christie Brinkley, of someone who had always been beautiful and always would be. Was beautiful almost by habit. "Is it Mr. Kellaway?" she asked. "Or Deputy Kellaway?" Rickles cracked her rear with one hand, and she jumped away laughing and rubbing her bottom. "You hush up, woman. You ruin everything." "Ruining men's plans is my life's work," she said and wandered off, swinging her hips in a provocative sort of way. Or maybe that was just how she walked. When she'd gone, Kellaway looked at Rickles and said, "Deputy?" The police chief's eyes glittered damply with emotion. "That's supposed to be a surprise. We're going to make you an honorary deputy next month, give you a key to the city, too. Big ceremony. When we announce it, try and pretend you didn't know."
"Do I get my very own badge?"
"Bet your ass," Rickles said and laughed a husky, beery laugh. "What I wonder, how come you're not a deputy for real?"
"I applied. You turned me down."
"Me?" Rickles put a hand to his chest and opened his eyes wide in stunned disbelief.
"Well, the department, anyway."
"Didn't you serve in Iraq?"
"Mm-hmm."
"And we turned you down. Why?"
"One position, 50 applicants, and I came up short in the melanin department."
Rickles nodded sadly.
"Christ, isn't that always the story? Though no matter how much you do to show you care about diversity, it's never enough. Did you read that hit piece the Digest ran about the drama student?"
"No." "So, 20 years ago, there's an APB out for a deranged African-American with a knife who cut up a white couple and stole their Miata and a Hermes purse full of loot. Wife died. Husband pulled through. Cops traced the Miata to a parking lot in the black and blue and saw a guy matching the description walking away from it, holding a knife, purse over his shoulder.
They tell him to get face down. He runs instead. He goes around the corner of a little shopping plaza, then changes his mind and turns back. When the cops come around the corner, they run smack into him. They think he's charging, and one of them blasts his black ass. Well, turned out he wasn't holding a knife, it was a CD. The Hermes purse over his shoulder, it was a Little Mermaid backpack he was carrying for a cousin of his. He was a 17-year-old slickster who did summer stock theater and who was applying to the London School of Drama. He ran because he'd been wandering around opening cars, grabbing stuff, petty thievery. Basically, he died of a guilty conscience. In his mind, Kellaway shot the Muslim woman all over again. It made him angry, thinking about her, trying to figure out why the bitch had stood up, why she didn't stay still. He resented her for making him shoot her.
"Adrenaline gets pumping," Kellaway said. "It's dark. You know the guy you're hunting has already sliced some people up, but he's crazy. I don't see how you blame the cops for shooting."
"You don't. And a grand jury didn't. But it was a scandal and a heartbreak. The cop who shot the kid developed a serious drug and alcohol problem, poor guy, and later had to be fired for domestic abuse. Anyway, the cousin with the Little Mermaid backpack witnesses the shooting. 15 years later, she's working for the St. Pacenti Digest, and she writes this great big goddamn expose about it, all about systemic racism and Florida policing and the reflective tendency to protect officers who abuse the badge. Anyway, I sat down with her, gave her an interview, said all the things I had to say. I bragged on our hiring of minorities, said 1993 was literally a different century, said that it's our job to make certain the black community sees us as an ally, not an occupying power. I made sure there were nothing but black faces in the typing pool when I led her to my office. I even had our IT guy sitting at one detective's desk. I had the dude who cleans our windows at another. It was so black in there you'd think she'd walked into a Luther Vandross concert instead of a police station. You do an interview like that, you got two choices. Either you say what they want you to say, or you get smeared by the press for committing a thought crime. I didn't like doing it, but I got through it. You might want to remember that when she talks to you.
What do you mean, when she talks to me?
She's on your ass now, partner. Aisha Lanternglass. The girl who wrote up the story of the dead drama student, and who made my whole department look like the local chapter of the KKK. They've got her covering the mall story. You want to watch out for her, Kellaway. She does hate Whitey. Kellaway sipped his Corona and thought it over.
"They ever get the guy who sliced up the couple?"
he asked finally.
"The black dude with the knife?"
Rickles shook his head ruefully. "There was no black dude with a knife. Turned out hubby had a girlfriend. He murdered his wife, then had his honey stab him a few times to make it look like he'd been attacked as well. Then he had her drive off in the Miata and park it in the black and blue. We got the girlfriend on a security camera, abandoning the car in the lot." He sighed. "Shit, I wish we had more security footage of what happened in Devotion Diamonds. We've got her going in, but nothing from what went down in there. I wish we did. I know telling stories would sure as shit like to have it."
"So you can't lift it off Roger Lewis's computer?"
The security footage for Devotion Diamonds fed to the big iMac in Lewis's office, and at some point the computer had toppled off the desk. Kellaway had made sure it couldn't be turned on again by giving it his boot a time or two. Rickles wiggled one hand in a gesture that seemed to mean maybe yes, maybe no. "The tech guys think that there's a chance they can rescue the hard drive, but I'll believe it when I see it." He sipped his beer and said, "Maybe if we can save it, telling stories will want to have us back on." If the tech guys rescued the hard drive, it would show Kellaway putting a bullet through a 6-month-old and his mother, then using Becky Colbert's gun to kill Bobby Lutz. Kellaway hoped that if such a thing did come to pass, he had another gun by then. He could imagine quite calmly sitting on the toilet in the master bathroom and putting the snub nose of a .38 against the roof of his mouth while cops shouted in the next room. He could do it. He knew he could do it. Swallow a bullet. Better to die his way than to live life mocked by the tabloids, loathed by the public, and separated from his child.
to say nothing of what would happen to him if he wound up in prison. The thought of sitting on one toilet brought to mind another, and he said,
"When do you think I'll be able to get back into the mall? I'd like to collect some of my things, and maybe, I don't know, walk the scene."
"Give it a week. After they open again, we'll walk the scene together if you want. I'd like that myself. See it again through your eyes." Kellaway wondered if Rickles was going to move in with him, if he should buy bunk beds. When Kellaway looked around, a perfect 10 was standing in front of him, a blonde who had to be at least 6 feet tall, wearing a flower-print pencil skirt and a satiny white silk blouse and a straw cowboy hat. She held the hands of two small children, one on either side of her. One of them was a profoundly ugly fat girl with an upturned piggy nose, her pink Hannah Montana shirt riding up her bulging belly. The boy looked like the mini-me version of Jay Rickles, a towhead with narrow blue eyes and a stubborn, mulish expression on his face. Their mother was so tall they had to stretch their arms up to reach her hands.
"Mr. Kellaway," said the perfect 10, "I'm Mary Ann Winslow, Jay's daughter, and my children would like to say something to you."
"Thank you," the children recited together.
"What for?" Mary Ann said, pulling one arm then the other.
The girl with the porcine features said,
"For saving our lives,"
and began to pick her nose. The boy said,
"For shooting the bad guy."
"They were in the mall," Rickles said, turning his head, and giving Kellaway a watery-eyed look of wonder and gratitude. "Bullets flying a couple 100 feet away from them. They were on the carousel."
"Oh, Dad," Mary Ann said, "we didn't even get inside. We were going to ride the carousel, but when we reached the doors, the security guard sent us back to our car. It was all over by then. We missed the action by 10 minutes.
Rickles told Kellaway, "But for the grace of God," and held out his bottle. They clinked long necks.
"What did you shoot her with?" the little boy asked Kellaway.
Mary Ann jerked his arm.
"Merritt, rude."
"A .327 Ruger Federal," said Kellaway. "You know about guns?"
The boy said, "I got a Browning Buck Mark 22.
"Merritt, you do not got a Browning Buck Mark."
"I do too."
"You have a Browning Buck Mark,"
Mary Ann said and rolled her eyes at her son's disgraceful indifference to proper grammar.
"You like guns?"
Kellaway asked, leaning forward, resting his elbows on his knees. Merritt nodded.
"I have a boy only a bit younger than you. He likes guns, too. Sometimes we go fishing together, and then afterward we'll walk along the beach and find bottles to shoot. Once we found a smelly old pair of boots and shot them. We were trying to make them dance."
"Did you?"
Merritt asked. Kellaway shook his head.
"No. We just knocked them over."
Merritt stared at him with his deep blue eyes for another moment, as if in a trance, then jerked his head up and looked at his mom.
"Can I play Xbox now?"
"Merritt Winslow, so rude."
"It's all right. Old people are boring," Kellaway said. "My own son told me so once."
Mary Ann Winslow mouthed the words, "Thank you," and walked the children away, still holding their arms up over their heads so they had to skip and hurry to stay on their feet. Rickles sighed and leaned back into the couch. He was staring absently at the TV when he said,
"I keep meaning to ask you about the gun."
"Hmm?"
Kellaway asked. The back of his neck prickled.
"Just, I did a search, and you don't have any guns registered to you in this state."
Rickles scratched an eyebrow, didn't look at him.
"That might be a problem, you know."
"Oh, it's registered to Falcon Security. It's their gun. You want me to see if I can get someone to find the paper on it? They're based in Texas. It might be registered there, or maybe..."
But Rickles didn't care and wasn't listening. He swatted Kellaway's shoulder in excitement and leaned forward. On the TV, there was a shot of the Miracle Falls Mall, the entrance to its parking lot blocked by a police cruiser.
"It's the new national normal," intoned a deep male voice.
You know the story. A disgruntled employee walks into her workplace with a gun and a heart full of malice and begins to kill. But what happened next at this shopping center in St. Pocenti, Florida, will surprise and inspire you.
Here we go, said Rickles. I'll tell you what, boy. I do like to see myself on TV.
Hey, did you get a call from Bill O'Reilly's people?
Yeah, and 2020.
We going to do them too?
I guess.
Good, Rickles said and sighed. I have days when I think about being killed in the line of duty, and you know what haunts me? The idea that I'll miss all that sweet, heartbreaking coverage when I'm gone.
What if you die in your own bed at 75 after an early morning screw?
I'd rather get blown away, Rickles said and took another pull on his beer. I'd prefer to die a legend, but I doubt I'll be that lucky.
I'll keep my fingers crossed for you, Kellaway said.
July 11, 10 a.m. When Jay Rickles told Kellaway that he had once stocked his office with black faces to put a black journalist at ease, he was guilty of exaggeration. He hadn't really planted his window washer at a desk and told him to pretend to be a detective. The window washer was Cambodian and wasn't even working that day. But it was true that Shane Wolfe, an IT guy from Atlantic Data Stream, had been in the office on the morning Lantern Glass arrived to interview Chief Rickles about the tragic death of an unarmed black youth in 1993 at the hands of the police. Shane was usually at the St. Pocenti Police Department two or three times a week to rebuild their office network, which was still improbably running Windows XP. And it was also true that Rickles had planted Shane at an empty detective's desk close to the front door, so Aisha Lanternglass would spot a black man in a tie as soon as she walked in. At the time, Lanternglass had nodded to Wolfe, and he had mildly nodded back, and from that moment on they had studiously ignored each other. She knew him right away, of course, would have known him even if he didn't service the computers at the Digest. Wolfe and Coulson had gone to school together, had dated some of the same girls, but it wouldn't have served to acknowledge him openly. As it happened, Shane Wolfe's frequent jobs for the St. Pocenti police were his highest-paying gigs. First the cops paid him, and then Aisha did, if he came across anything she could use. On Thursday, Wolfe showed up at the Digest just as Aisha was finishing her morning workout. She was running steps, two flights up and then back, 48 steps in a complete circuit. She kept her free weights tucked in the shadows under the staircase. There was no space for them in the four-room apartment she shared with Dorothy, and Tim Chen didn't mind.
"How many times do you go up and down?"
Shane asked her, his voice echoing in the concrete stairwell. She trotted to the bottom of the steps.
50 rotations. Almost done. 5 left. Are you crying?
Shane Wolfe leaned into the open metal door that led to the parking lot. He didn't look like a tech nerd. He was 6'3", maybe 200 pounds, his neck as thick as his head. His eyes were bloodshot and streaming and tragic.
"It's the smoke. I drove through a big cloud of it on the way here. I've never used my windshield wipers to brush away sparks before. They had me over to the PD yesterday to scrub the hard drives and vice. About once a week they go looking for online porn and find Russian malware instead. Anyway, while I was over there, I saw the ballistics report on the mall thing."
She started running upstairs again. Her calves throbbed.
"Hold that thought. I'll be back."
"Hey," he said, "is that good for your glutes, all those stairs?"
"Must be."
She hesitated, almost missed a step, kept going, didn't answer him. Tim Chen was waiting for her at the top of the steps. He had pushed open the Digest office's fire door and sat on the landing, leaning against it, with Aisha's battered old MacBook in his lap. He was editing her piece.
"I gotta cut these two paragraphs at the end," he told her in a remote, distracted sort of way. "You're 500 words over, and this stuff isn't important."
"The hell I'm 500 words over?" She slowed at the landing, put her hands on her knees, and inhaled deeply. Lantern Glass craned her head to see what he was cutting.
Oh, come on, Tim. Don't cut that. Why would you cut that?
You make it sound like Kellaway got kicked out of the army. He didn't get kicked out. He served his country for a full tour in Iraq. Then he came home and stopped the mass shooting. He was ADSEP, administratively separated. That's kicked out.
Don't you have terrible things to do to your body? Tim asked.
Jesus, she said and trotted away down the steps. Wolf watched her approach, his reddened eyes streaming. He looked like a mourner at the edge of a grave.
Okay, she said. Give it to me. Sources close to the investigation say,
Becky Colbert shot Roger Lewis 3 times with a .357 mag. The first one nailed him in the chest while he was facing her. He turned to run, and she tagged him in the back and the left buttock. At that point, Becky Colbert probably tried to leave the office and was surprised by Mrs. Haswar. The way it looks, she slew the baby and Yasmin both with just one shot, right to the center mass.
Slew? That's a very Old Testament way of putting it, she said. Maybe you should be a writer.
Shortly after Colbert killed the Haswars, Mr. Kellaway entered Devotion Diamonds. She retreated into the office. They exchanged words. Boom, boom, he fires 2 shots. One missed, the other caught her in the left lung. She went down, and he turned away to attend to Mrs. Haswar. Bob Lutz walked in and approached the shooter to see if she was still alive. Unfortunately for him, she was. Becky Colbert shot him right between the eyes, military precision. At that point, Kellaway disarmed her, but it's pretty much over anyhow. She bled out shortly after emergency services arrived on the scene.
Lantern Glass was running up the stairs by then and was too out of breath to reply. She climbed 24 steps to where her editor sat on the concrete landing.
You almost done? Tim Chen asked. You're making me tired, and I'm only watching.
Why are you cutting the stuff about his military service? She gasped. He read her own article back to her. Kellaway may have missed his chance at heroic distinction in the Gulf. His tour of duty was troubled, and he did not receive an honorable discharge. But following the events at the Miracle Falls, he'll be celebrated for his service at last.
Why would you write that? His army record a decade ago isn't relevant. You're taking a perfectly satisfying feel-good story and stapling on this strange, catty ending.
Catty? I was going to say bitchy, but it isn't politically correct.
He was dismissed from the army for excessive use of force as an MP. He routinely drew his firearm in non-threatening situations and once punched a handcuffed prisoner. Look at the record. This guy is not a war hero, no matter how they made it sound on Telling Stories the other night.
Out of curiosity, Tim Chen said, this guy Kellaway punched back when he was an MP, the handcuffed prisoner? Was he a black guy?
Oh, for fuck's sake, she said, and ran back down the stairs to Wolf.
Wolf dabbed at the corners of his eyes with a white handkerchief.
I can show you some good stretches.
For what? She said.
For your glutes. You want to stretch them out before you abuse them like that.
She slowed again as she approached the bottom of the steps.
You said something funny a minute ago. You said, the way it looks, she slew the baby and Yasmin Haswar with 1 shot.
Yeah? And you made fun of me.
No, hang on. What do you mean, the way it looks?
He wiped under his eyes.
That's the only theory that fits the facts. They're still digging around for the bullet. It went through a mirror in the drywall behind and disappeared into the bowels of the Miracle Falls Mall.
Slew? Bowels? Glutes?
You're full of interesting words, Shane.
Can I make a suggestion?
She started back up the stairs.
What?
Verbally admiring a woman's glutes isn't the right way to lean into asking her out. Say something about her laugh.
She was 20 steps up when he shouted after her,
You'd have to laugh for me to say something nice about it. I work with what I have.
Chen was still sitting there at the top of the steps.
Yeah, all right,
Lantern Glass said. When he was with the military police, Kellaway handcuffed a black private in front of his girlfriend and then punched him. And last year, he pulled a gun on a black teenager who he thought was stealing from the mall. Turned out the kid was an out-of-uniform employee moving stock from one store to another. And what matters here isn't that they were both black. What matters is that Kellaway has a history of going Rambo, acting violently without thought. There's nothing in the article about him harassing employees. She jogged in place in front of him. No, my source asked me not to print that story. Point is, I don't think it would be the worst thing for this paper to at least hint at the possibility that Randall Kellaway is predisposed to using excessive force. Just in case the cops recover the security footage on the conveniently destroyed iMac, and we find out he shot Becky Colbert when she was trying to surrender. Like the way Coulson got shot? She quit jogging and gripped her knees and lowered her head. When she inhaled, it felt like there was a cactus in her chest where her heart belonged, needles bristling against her lungs. Jesus, she said. That's a low fucking blow, Tim.
Is it?
He said calmly. You hear this story about Randall Kellaway harassing a black kid. You hear about him assaulting a black soldier in the army. Now he's a hero, and he's got Jay Rickles hugging him on TV and calling him a good guy with a gun. If Kellaway's story came apart, you could humiliate the both of them. You could take out two with one shot.
No, Tim. Words aren't bullets. When Yasmin Haswar and her baby hit the floor, that was two taken out with one shot.
Tim Chen firmly and forcefully tapped two keys. One of them was delete. Give me a reason to trash his military record, and we'll put it in the very next story. But your personal issues don't count as a reason. She was surprised at the sudden deep stab of hurt in her stomach. It was on her lips to say, fuck you, but she didn't say it. It was on her lips to say, that's so fucking unfair, Tim. But she didn't say that either. She turned and ran away, ran back down the steps, because the thought was in her mind that it wasn't unfair at all, and maybe if she moved quickly enough, she could leave her shame behind, up on the top landing with her friend and editor. When she got to the bottom of the stairs, Shane Wolf said,
smoke is bothering you too, huh?
What?
Your eyes, he said and pointed. You're crying too. Want my hanky?
She snatched it away from him and wiped her face. Thank you.
I know a pretty good rooftop bar, he said. It's up 5 stories. I could take the elevator and you could run, and we could meet at the top for a beer. It'd be great exercise.
It's hard to go out when you have an 8-year-old. She said, I can afford to pay you for the ballistics report, or I can pay for a sitter, but I can't pay for both.
So? The report's on me, then. The beer's, too.
She very gently punched him in the chest, and turned, and started back up the stairs.
That's sweet, Shane, but I don't want to take advantage. And stop staring at my glutes.
Lantern Glass was a dozen steps up when she paused and looked back. Shane Wolf stood in the open door to the parking lot, covering his eyes to shield them from the sight of her glutes.
So, wait,
she called down to him. She stopped running, stood there with her fists balled on her hips. 4 shots when she killed Lewis and the Haswars. A pause. Then 2 more when Kellaway enters the store and shoots her. Another pause. Then 1 more when Becky Colbert executes Bob Lutz. 7 shots in, what, 5 minutes?
That's about it, he said.
Huh,
she said, turning to climb on. When she got to the top of the stairs, Tim Chen was still sitting there, back to the open fire door, holding her laptop.
I want to apologize, he said, for what I said a minute ago.
Don't apologize, she said. Just stick it back in. He sighed heavily. I can't think of 1 good reason to even play footsie with defaming the guy.
How about this? She said. The cops say Colbert fired 4 times. 3 into Rog Lewis, 1 into Yasmin and her baby. A minute later, Kellaway enters the store and fires 2. Hits her 1, misses 1. Finally, about a minute after that, there's the last shot. The one that kills Bob Lutz. That's what the forensics report tells us.
Okay.
But there's an eyewitness, really an ear witness, who heard the whole thing. And he said it was 3 shots, a pause, then 2, a pause, then 2 more. So, your ear witness was scared to death and got it wrong. Happens all the time. He was texting his girlfriend. He texted her after each burst of gunfire. He was sure. 3, 2, 2. Not 4, 2, 1. I don't even know what that means. It means there was another shot after the one that killed Bob Lutz. Explain that. Tim Chen couldn't. He sat there tapping 1 finger against the edge of the laptop. Did your ear witness show you the text messages proving he heard what he says he heard when he heard it? Did you see the timestamps? No, she admitted. I had to pick up Dorothy from tennis camp. I didn't get a chance to look at the texts, but I'm sure he'd share them if I asked. Tim nodded and said, Okay, well, that might be interesting. But I don't see what it has to do with Randall Kellaway's piss-poor military record. Nothing. So why denigrate his service at all, even casually? To fuck with him and see what happens. You can find out a lot about someone by fucking with them.
Yeah? You learn that in journalism school, Aisha?
That ain't J school, brother, she said. That's old school.
July 12, 6:13 p.m. They taped for the O'Reilly Factor at the same local TV studio where they'd recorded their bits for Telling Stories and 2020. When Rickles and Kellaway came out into the warm, smoky evening, Aisha Lanternglass was waiting for them. She cut them off before they could get to Rickles' pickup.
Hey, guys, she said. What do you say about giving your local paper 10 minutes? Or do I gotta have a TV show for you to talk to me?
She grinned to flash her very white teeth, razzing them, just one of the guys. She was trim and fit in a pair of blue jeans and a sleeveless black top, strappy sandals. She'd brought her daughter with her, which was cheap manipulation in Kellaway's opinion. The little girl sat on the hood of the world's crappiest Passat. Her daughter wore a crocheted beanie with a cat's face on it, gray cat ears poking up. The kid ignored the grown-ups, leafing through the pages of a picture book. Jay Rickles beamed, creases deepening in his seamed face. He hitched his belt up.
Aisha, I got your voicemail. Getting back here has been at the top of my list of things to do for about 3 days now. You want my secretary to give you a ring, see if we can pencil something in?
That's great, she said. If you could give me 10 minutes right now, and then if we could follow up in a couple of days with a longer sit-down, that would be perfect.
Rickles glanced at Kellaway. We better give her her 10 minutes. I'm afraid if I try to climb into the truck, she'll tackle me. Kellaway found it difficult to look her directly in the face. His insides were hot, sick, and inflamed. He had heard all about her article, trashing his military service first thing in the morning. They'd hashed it out on the morning news shows. New details have emerged about Rand Kellaway, the hero of last week's Miracle Falls shooting, said the newsboy, a kid who looked like he ought to be bagging groceries, not blabbing on TV. The St. Pacenti Digest is reporting today that Mr. Kellaway was released from the U.S. military in 2003 after repeated allegations that he was guilty of using excessive force in his time as an MP. Gun control activists have already seized on the piece to argue that Kellaway escalated the situation by entering with a loaded... Later, Kellaway found a wrinkled copy of the digest in the green room at the TV studio and read the article for himself. There was nothing new in the whole story until the last couple of paragraphs, where they made him sound like a third-world torturer instead of a soldier. A postage stamp-sized photograph of Aisha Lanternglass ran alongside the piece, grinning, just the way she was grinning now. His first thought was that George would hear all about it. Holly had emailed a couple days before to say that George never missed the local news now, watched the morning show before school and the evening show at dinner to see what they were going to say about his father today. Now George would hear that the army had thrown his father out because he couldn't control his temper. George would hear that his father wasn't good enough to serve his country. It had been all Kellaway could do to maintain his composure during the Bill O'Reilly taping. The parking lot in front of the local studio was a wide expanse of brand-new blacktop, soft in the lingering heat of the day. The sun was still up, but it was impossible to see it. The horizon was an ochre thunderhead of smoke. Lanternglass held her phone out to record their conversation, stabbing it at Kellaway like a knife. "Mr. Kellaway, it's been almost a week since the shooting. I think what most of what our readers want to know is, how are you doing?"
"Just fine. No trouble sleeping. Ready to go back to work."
"When do you think that might be?"
"Mall's opening tomorrow. I'll be there for the first shift."
"That's dedication."
"It's called a work ethic," he said.
"I wonder if you've had a chance to speak with the families of the bereaved. Have you been in touch with Mr. Haswar, Yasmin's husband, or Bob Lutz's parents?"
"Why would I do that? Just to say, I'm sorry I didn't save the people you love,"
biting off his words a little. Jay Rickles patted his shoulder. "There'll be a time to reach out to them for sure, maybe after they've had a chance to begin the healing process, and after Mr. Kellaway has had a chance to heal himself." Kellaway thought there was something cautionary in the way Rickles was petting him like a dog. "Down, boy." He shrugged so Rickles would stop doing it. "I'm sure after what you've been through, your own family has been a source of strength," Lanternglass said. "You have a son, yes?"
"Yes."
"And he lives with his mother? Where is that? I'd love to know a little more about your family situation. I gather you're separated. Are you seeking a divorce? I checked the county records."
"Did you? Looking around for a little dirt? Who told you to start digging into the separation?"
The little girl over on the hood of the car lifted her chin and stared at them, her attention drawn by Kellaway's raised voice. "No one. We always talk to the family after something like this."
"Not this time. Stay away from my wife and my boy."
"Mom?" asked the little girl sitting on the Passat, her voice querulous and uneasy. Lanternglass darted a look back at her, waved. "Just another minute, Dorothy." She regarded Kellaway again, smiling in a puzzled sort of way, and said softly, "Hey, we're all pals here. Let's not upset my kid with a lot of shouting."
"Did you worry you might upset my kid when you smeared my military record in your article this morning? Did that thought ever cross your mind?"
Rickles wasn't smiling anymore. He patted Kellaway's shoulder again and said, "All right now, all right. Rand has been under a lot of strain. Aisha, I'm going to ask you to show some consideration and go easy on him." She nodded, took a step back. She wasn't smiling anymore either. "Okay, sorry. I know it's been an exhausting week. Jay, have your office call me. We'll make an appointment to talk about the police response."
"Will do,"
Rickles said. He had Kellaway by the arm now, gripping him just above the elbow, and began to steer him toward the truck. "Oh, hey," Lanternglass said. "One more thing while I've got you. The security department at Miracle Falls Mall isn't supplied with guns. Was your firearm your own personal weapon?" Kellaway knew a trap when he heard it, knew she wanted him on record admitting he owned a firearm in defiance of the restraining order.
"Wouldn't you like it if it was?"
His stomach hurt like cancer. As the two men drove out of the parking lot, they passed Lanternglass sitting on the hood of her Passat, rubbing her daughter's back and staring at the truck. Eyes narrowed in speculation. Rickles pulled out so fast the rear tires spit pebbles. He accelerated north up the highway, toward St. Pocenti.
"The hell was that all about, partner?"
Rickles said. For the first time ever, he sounded clipped and a little cross.
"My kid watches the news morning, noon, and night to hear the latest about his old man. She made it sound like I left the army in disgrace, and he's going to hear that.
He's also going to hear about you getting made special deputy soon enough. Lantern Glass is a rinky-dink reporter for a rinky-dink local paper. Most of what she writes is there to fill space between ads and wedding announcements. But you go making a lot of smoke, she's going to think there's fire.
Speaking of," he said, scowling.
They drove into a thick, fluffy cloud of it. The smoke burned Kellaway's eyes. They drove another half a mile, and then Rickles said, "Is there anything I need to know about that gun?"
"Yeah," Kellaway said. "If I didn't have it, there'd be a whole lot more people dead."
Rickles didn't reply. They went on in an uncomfortable silence for 1 minute, and then two. And finally Rickles said something obscene under his breath and turned on the radio. They listened to news the rest of the way back, didn't say a word to each other. Bombs in Iraq. Sanctions against Iran. And in bad news for the firefighters trying to tamp down the Ocala blaze, the wind was shifting toward the east. With moderate gales expected, the fire now endangered homes and businesses on the western edge of St. Pocenti. More on that story, the anchor promised, as it developed. 6:27 p.m.
"Are we going?" Dorothy asked. "Or are we just going to sit here?"
"Just sit here for a minute," Lantern Glass said. "Mama might need to make a call." They idled in the car in front of the TV station with the windows down and the music low. Lantern Glass went over it again in her mind, playing back what Kellaway had said and how he'd said it. Kellaway hadn't wanted to look at her, but when he did, when he met her eyes, she felt him hating her. She had wanted to fuck with him, wanted to see how he'd respond. Now she knew. What he made her think of was a gun, a big cocked pistol, the kind of thing Wyatt Earp carried around. In her mind, Lantern Glass pictured this enormous cannon with the hammer pulled back, resting on the passenger seat of a car as the vehicle sped along a bumpy, rutted dirt road. When the car jolted, the gun shimmied and slid a little farther across the seat toward the edge. Any fool could see what would happen if it was knocked down. It would go off. She had the nasty idea that if Kellaway were knocked down, he would go off too. She'd asked if it was his gun, and he'd said, "Wouldn't you like it if it was?" Why would she like it?
"Mom, I have to pee."
"You always have to pee.
You got a bladder about the size of a walnut," Lantern Glass said, and she picked up her phone and dialed Richard Watkins at the state police. Watkins answered on the second ring.
"Flagler County Sheriff's Department, this is Richard Watkins, Victim Services. How can I help you?"
"Richard Watkins, it's Aisha Lantern Glass, St. Pocenti Digest."
She had done a piece on Watkins the year before, after he started a trauma support group for children, busing the kids to Orlando so they could swim with dolphins. Aisha thought it was sweet, and big-time clickbait, but Dorothy disapproved, said the dolphins probably needed a trauma support group of their own, since they were prisoners who had to entertain tourists if they wanted to eat.
"Hey," Watkins said, "if you're calling about the mall shooting, you want to stick to St. Pocenti PD. That one is theirs, not ours. And if you're calling about the fire, hang up, drive to your office, and pack all your junk before that place goes up in smoke. The blaze is turning your way. There might be an evacuation order issued tomorrow morning."
"No shit?" she asked.
"No shit.
Ugh." Dorothy kicked the back of her seat.
"Mom?"
Lantern Glass said, "Hey, Watkins, I'm actually calling to see if you know who at the sheriff's department serves papers, divorce, subpoenas, that kind of thing."
"Well, we got a few people do that, but Lauren Acosta is our head process server. If you want to find out about someone who had papers served on them, Either she did it herself, or she can tell you who did.
That's great. Can I talk to her?
I can give you her cell. I don't know if she'll answer. She's in Alaska. She's doing a cruise with her sisters. They're taking pictures of icebergs and reindeer and other shit you could get frostbite from just thinking about. She's got a North Pole fetish. In December, she goes out to deliver subpoenas wearing a Santa cap.
Wow, Lantern Glass said.
Nothing gets a guy into the Christmas spirit like a woman in a Santa cap handing him divorce papers.
Yeah, please, let me have her number. I just want to have a quick word, if she has a minute.
Dorothy kicked the back of her mother's seat again, just as she thanked Watkins and hung up.
You want to cut it out, Lantern Glass said. You want me to pee all over the back seat?
There's a McDonald's up the road. We can use the restroom there. She put the Passat in gear and made a 180 so the car was pointed toward the street.
Somewhere else, Dorothy said.
She plucked at one ear of her kitten cap.
McDonald's falls short of my ethical standards. Meat is murder.
You want to learn about murder? Lantern Glass said. Kick the back of my seat one more time. 8:11 p.m. Rickles took them to his hacienda on Kiwi Boulevard, where Kellaway had left his car. The police chief told Kellaway to swing back by the house tomorrow, just before 11, and they could go to the mall together.
I can meet you there, Kellaway said. That'll be easier.
He dropped out of the truck, his shoes crunching on crushed shells. We better go together, for the candle lighting ceremony. The news people want to photograph your return to the mall. There was going to be a candlelighting ceremony in the food court out in front of the carousel to honor the fallen. Afterward, the mall was celebrating a special day of remembrance, with 20% to 40% off selected items in every store.
Who cares what the news people want?
Kellaway stood in the courtyard, peering up into Rickles' truck. Rickles slung one arm over the steering wheel and leaned across the passenger seat toward Kellaway. He was smiling, but his eyes were cool, almost unfriendly.
You ought to.
Lantern Glass is a tiresome little race activist, kind of person who believes every cop can't wait to take a fire hose to a crowd of black people. But she's nobody's fool, and you just about begged her to go poking around in your past. I don't know what kind of embarrassing shit you've done, but I'm sure I'll be reading all about it by the end of the week, if not sooner. You got any sense at all? You'll give yourself a good shave first thing tomorrow morning, slap on your best cologne, and be ready to light candles with me at 11 a.m. The press is lazy. If you give them a feel-good story and a silver platter, they'll eat it. And you want to keep them well fed. Otherwise, they might turn their forks and knives on you. Capiche? Kellaway didn't want to go back to the mall with Rickles. He wanted to get there ahead of him, ahead of everyone, early enough to visit the little employee's bathroom behind lids. He wanted to argue, to say, truthfully, that he had never once arrived at work as late as 11 a.m. But then he observed again the icy way Rickles was watching him above a thin, no longer friendly smile, and he nodded.
Sounds good,
he said and slammed the door of the truck. He pulled out of the driveway in his Prius, hooked left when he should have turned right. He didn't want to go home, didn't want to see the TV vans parked out front, didn't want the TV people to see him. Instead, he turned the car out of town, nosing into the smoke and gathering night. Jim Hurst's farmhouse was dark, an angular arrangement of black boxes against the sky, the color of cinders. The only light in the whole place was the television. It cast a sickly blue glow, visible through the holes where the windows were missing on the western side of the house. The big sheets of plastic draped over that end of the building rippled in the gusting wind, making slow, heavy, ominous slapping sounds. Kellaway got out of his car and stood beside it, and listened to the tidal shush of the wind. He couldn't hear the TV. Sound had to be off. He started toward the house, his feet crunching in the gravel, and then stopped moving, froze to listen. He had heard footsteps. He was almost sure of it. It seemed to him there was a man on the other side of his car. He could see him in his peripheral vision.
Kellaway found he was afraid to look at him directly, couldn't will himself to turn his head. It was Jim Hurst. Jim, who had not walked for more than a decade. Jim, walking easily.